Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Labor Day sounds the official end of summer vacation. The leaves on the tree are starting to show their first signs of autumn colors. The UNC Tar Heels just kicked off the NCAA football season against their arch rivals, the South Carolina Gamecocks. And hundreds of thousands of students have made their way back to their college classrooms to learn about Aristotle, quantum physics, and, of course, the social scientific study of religion. The staff here at Research on Religion try to do our part to enhance that educational mission by bringing all of you some of the most interesting scholarship on religion that is being conducted today. Considering that we are a free educational resource that is used on a number of college campuses, and also given that many parents are suffering the sticker shock of higher tuition and probably wondering what their dollars are buying, I thought it would be a good time to deviate a little bit from our usual discussion on religion and focus instead on the state of higher education. The state of religious higher education will also factor into our discussion, but my intent today is to talk more broadly about the direction in which universities are headed. I've been prompted to do this by the publication of two short yet provocative articles by Professor Hunter Baker, published in Renewing Minds, a journal published out of Union University. These articles are entitled The Future of Higher Education and The State of Christian Higher Education, and they will set the framework for today's discussion. Hunter has been a previous guest on our show, talking about his book, The End of Secularism. He has also written an enormously popular textbook entitled Political Thought, A Student's Guide, and is an associate professor of political science at Union University, as well as the associate dean of arts and sciences there. We will link to his writings on our website, and I think he would greatly appreciate it if you took a look at those scholarly offerings. Hunter, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. Now I have to make one small correction. I am no longer an associate dean. I'm in the second year of being a regular dean.
A regular dean.
Yes,
that's unlike a leaded dean.
Ascended from the administrative purgatory of associate deandom to real deandom.
Well, that's one of the things I want to talk about, because here at the University of Washington, there's a lot of deans, associate deans, provosts, vice provosts, and that oftentimes becomes very difficult to keep track of what they're doing. And we want to talk about higher education today, and particularly we'd like to also move in what the role of the Christian university might play in intellectual life. But you have this unique position of being now a regular dean. But you also teach. I mean, you're teaching this quarter, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you're in the classroom mixing it up with students. You're a regular dean at Union University, which we mentioned, and that's a Baptist educational institution in Jackson, Tennessee, for those of you who are not in the know. And I would like to know a little bit about that deanship that you have. I think most people know what a teaching professor does. They're in the classroom teaching. You also do research. But when we hear dean or associate dean, we don't know what that kind of stuff is. So kind of explain to our audience how you're earning your paycheck.
Sure. The job that I have right now is a position called dean of instruction, which here at Union is the only place I've encountered the dean of instruction. I think at a lot of other places it might be an associate provost-type position. Basically, I have responsibility for faculty development. I am in control of the curricular process, so for instance, changing the curriculum. I'm in charge of the honors program, the sort of first-year experience gateway program, and anything that has to do with instruction, so instructional technology, things like grade appeals, unhappy parents, any sort of combination of the things that I have stated fall under the Dean of Instruction's portfolio.
Do you deal with a lot of unhappy parents?
No, I'm happy to say that I have not had to do that a lot. You know, maybe once every few months.
Okay, that's good. And in my 20 years at the University of Washington, I've only had one parent call me. So I'm kind of amazed by that because I'm, you know, upwards of around 20,000 students over the course of my time here.
That's right.
So quite amazing. So I have a few other things. You're responsible for, you said, faculty development. What is faculty development? As a faculty member, I'm feeling that I don't want to be developed, or at least
developed
by
you. That is a common feeling among faculty. At a place like Union, where we really have a mission, you know, sort of a distinctive mission related to our faith. One of the things that we are concerned about, as are many, many schools in our sector, is whether or not the faculty carry our mission into the classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that you're doing this podcast for Baylor, and of course I was at Baylor some time ago when the controversy was really going on. And one of the questions was how Baylor would carry its mission into its teaching and research at the institution. And if you asked President Herbert Reynolds, who preceded Dr. Sloan, he might say something like that we bring our Christian mission into being in teaching and research largely through being nicer to our students than the people at the University of Texas down the road. And Robert Sloan had a different view of that. He wanted to see, he believed that there's actually some intellectual content to Christianity that should actually affect the way you think and teach and do research. And so kind of pushed for that to become a reality among the faculty. Now, faculty development is one way you do that, by hosting a variety of programs to encourage them to think along those lines. Of course, the easier way is just to hire people who are sort of already interested in that to begin with.
Mm-hmm. So faculty development deals with the hiring, but also programs. Do you call people out on a retreat somewhere in the backwoods of Tennessee to talk about their mission and give them new ideas and stuff? Is that kind
of... Well, you know, we have faculty workshops. We'll bring in speakers. And, you know, the questions of faith and learning are not the only things that we talk about in this sort of programming. We also deal with things like technology. How is technology going to affect us going forward? We had a huge plenary session with all the faculty last winter where we gathered together a variety of faculty, some who were totally in the tank for technology and others who were very skeptical about technology.
Mm-hmm.
And had a big panel discussion about that. The big thing being that we want people to start thinking about this and not just kind of be taken unawares by the changes that are occurring.
Now, you mentioned you brought together all of the faculty at Union for this plenary session. How many is all?
That's probably about 300.
Okay, so you got about 300 faculty and such.
The famous Spartans.
Aha, okay.
300.
Forging forward against the trends of secularism at the university.
That's right. There you go.
Very good. So that's faculty development. One of the other things that you mentioned is changing curriculum. How much influence do you have on curriculum there at Union University? And I bring this up is because at the University of Washington, we do have curriculum development that goes on at the university level and at the college level, but a lot of it is left to individual departments and individual faculty. So how much coordination do you do?
Well, if curricular changes are relatively small, then they can be left to a particular department or school, and then they would be dealt with by a smaller curriculum committee located in that school or college. If it is a larger change, meaning that either the scope of the change is fairly large or that it has the potential to affect other schools and departments at the university, then the university curriculum committee would handle, would have to preside over that proposed change. And then after the curriculum committee would deal with it, then we would go to the greater faculty where the entire faculty would vote on the change.
Give us an idea of a change that would require that kind of scope.
Okay, here's an example. We had our people in art wanted to start a program in aesthetics, and our philosophy folks objected to that because they felt that aesthetics was properly related to philosophy rather than to art. Therefore, this conflict required us to have to kind of negotiate through the curricular process, in which we ended up having the art people limit their program to visual aesthetics, at which point they were able to pass the proposal and start the program.
And the philosophers were okay with that.
And they were okay with that.
Because they don't do anything with visual stuff. They just all thinking in the mind, I guess.
Well, they were satisfied with a more limited definition of the aesthetics the art folks would be grappling with.
Okay. Well, that's kind of interesting. There's no proposal for some kind of interdisciplinary program?
That kind of thing could come up. It hasn't under my watch, but I'm sure that it has in the past.
Okay.
I'd be happy to see something like that, as I'm an interdisciplinary kind of guy.
Yeah, it's just it's weird when philosophers and artists fight. It must have been.
it was a very civilized fight.
Yeah, it was. I'm sure they used lots of big words that I probably wouldn't be able to understand or anything like that.
You would have fit in very nicely.
Yeah. Okay, so you deal with some of these bigger curricular changes and negotiations between these different departments and guiding the university here or there.
Yes.
You also teach. And
right.
That is relatively unusual for deans. We have a few associate deans at the University of Washington who might do one class a year. It's a significant reduction of their course load. But to have a full dean teaching in the classroom is somewhat unusual. How does that affect you in terms of your responsibilities at the university? Do you find that your administrative duties help to inform your classroom experience and vice versa, or no effect at all?
Well, here's what I would say. First of all, just to give you the parameters, when I was an associate dean, my load was 2-2, which is probably the standard load for a University of Washington professor.
Yeah, that's about right. We do four classes a year. I did 7 last year, though. So,
our normal faculty would teach 4-4. So as an associate dean, I taught 2 courses each semester. As a dean, the expectation is 1 course each semester. One thing that was interesting is last year I was acting Dean of Arts and Sciences, and I had already committed to teach 2 courses in the fall, so that left me with no courses in the spring. And I have to say that I just don't think I would want to do this job with no teaching. The semester without teaching, I don't know how other administrators feel about it, but for me, when there's no teaching going on, you start to kind of question your own existence and what you're doing at the university and why did you ever come here to do this work in the first place. You know, there's just something about, for me at least, there's something about the interaction with the young people and the way they think at this particular age of their lives that I need to be involved with as part of my work.
Yeah, I can imagine how that experience would help you to better informed decisions on curricular changes and also possibly faculty development, because you're there at the grassroots. I mean, at some large institutions like the University of Washington, University of Michigan, or other one of these Division I research schools, we rarely see our deans, and students rarely see the deans. I mean, there was a student in our department that wanted to take a complaint up right away from the dean, you know, from the classroom right up to the dean right away. And I was like, well, good luck with that. They're not going to have time for you there. You know, we have 5 different stages to go through until you get there. So the deans are pretty distant. But Union University, you guys are pretty close there to the students.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, because we still are teachers in our areas, you know, we're still involved with our department. And I have to say, I think that continuing to remain involved with teaching probably helps you as a decision maker, because it reminds you that everything that we're doing at the university, I mean, purportedly, everything that we're doing at the university is for the students. If you get disconnected from the students, then you can start to think about things in terms of various clientele. Right? Well, you know, this is what the professors need, or this is what business professors need. This is what athletics needs. I mean, you know, you can get all kind of obsessed with the different the different subgroups on campus. But if you stick with the teaching, then it reminds you, well, forget all that. That's all of secondary importance. The main reason we're here is for the students. Yeah. So faculty can want the things they want, but if we have to decide, we really should resolve things kind of in favor of the students and their development.
And that is a really good point. We're going to talk about the differences between various types of universities and colleges later on, but it's good to recognize that Union University is doing that. Now, you said you had 300 faculty. How many students do you have?
If you're talking about traditional undergrads, we're probably at about 2,600. But if you include our graduate schools, we have an unusual amount of graduate school here at Union, because we're heavily invested in healthcare, like nursing and pharmacy.
Hmm.
So probably over 5,000.
Okay, so your graduate population about doubles the size of the student
yes.
body. Okay. And you said traditional undergraduates. Are there untraditional undergraduates?
Yes, we also have an adult program that is effectively night school.
Okay.
And we have a fair number of students in that as well.
Okay, so we talked about what Union University is and your role in it. We've established your bona fides to talk about higher education because you've been at this gig for quite a while now. But I want to get to your article. So you recently wrote an article in Renewing Minds published by Union University, and we'll link back to that so people can read the actual article. The article is titled The Future of Higher Education. What is that future? Is that future so bright that we got to wear shades, or do you have some concerns about the direction that higher education happens to be moving?
It really depends on who you are as to whether the future is so bright you got to wear shades. I would advise everybody in higher ed to read Joseph Schumpeter, or at least become familiar with his concept of creative destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are at higher ed, that entire field of endeavor is squarely in the middle of the storm that we might call creative destruction. We're now everybody who made their business off of horses was radically affected by the invention of the car. We are in that situation now in higher education. Technology is radically changing the way that we go about this activity now. I don't think that the future is 900,000 people watch Michael Sandel teach justice, at least not all at once, at least not in a MOOC.
What's a MOOC?
I do think that
hang on, back up here.
Have a major effect.
Hang on, I got to back you up here a minute. You used a technical jargon term that some of our audience might not be familiar with, a MOOC. What is a MOOC? It sounds like some kind of Muppet.
That is a massive open online course.
Okay.
So you imagine someone basically broadcasting a course in the same way that you have this podcast. Someone else might have a video podcast of a course that they put online, and then you have the potential, the scale, possible scale is hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of people able to access that video podcast and watch it, and maybe even participate via some sort of chat function.
Hmm. And now you said Michael Sandel. Is he a big MOOCer?
Michael Sandel teaches the famous justice course at Harvard.
Ooh.
And at Harvard, it is a hugely popular course, has to be taught in a giant auditorium, which, of course, is, it's not really what the Harvard student naturally expects. That's not what they're paying for. They're not paying for that state school experience of the giant auditorium. But Sandel's course is so popular that is what they end up doing. And one of the things that is happening is that many schools are looking at Sandel's course and they're saying, what if we could just kind of like make a contract with Harvard X, which is kind of the Harvard online operation, and say, we could just plug in Michael Sandel into our curriculum and maybe pay some small fee for the use of his course, except it would count for, say, San Diego State credit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a novel way to get an education from some of the top scholars around. So from a student angle, that sounds like a pretty good deal. But on the other hand, as I listen to you talk about this, I'm starting to get worried that I'll be replaced by Michael Sandel.
Well, Tony Gill's course on religion and the state may become the standard course.
Oh, it might be. Yeah,
that may become the big MOOC that other schools are showing.
Hmm. Okay. So, tell me about. I mean, this is a big change, and.
Yes.
You're in a position, especially when you talk about changing curriculum, and you mentioned the plenary session you had with the faculty at Union about technology, and some were all in and others were like, ooh, what's going on here? Give us the lay of the land of how this Schumpeterian creative destruction is starting to change higher ed.
Well, I think that people are starting to realize that it does endanger careers.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no question about that. And so a number of people are reacting to that by kind of going all in, either because it's their inclination or they have a strong sense of self-preservation. And so you'll have some faculty who, instead of kind of grumbling about Moodle rooms or Blackboard, they're like jumping in with both feet and have totally mastered it. Or they become that faculty member who is pushing for every member of the class to have an iPad. I think that our graduate education programs do that. I think that they outfit every student with an iPad and then kind of push a lot of the programming through the iPad.
Wow.
And then on the other side, you have people who are sort of resolutely against it. You know, who would say, I think reasonably, that teaching has been a pretty much a stable, solid human activity for thousands of years,
mm-hmm.
And done in the same way largely for thousands of years, and they don't necessarily view innovations such as professional schools of pedagogy or things like that as really an improvement. And so they would kind of argue, let's just keep what has worked for a long, long time for human beings.
Now, as a part of full disclosure here, I have been approached to do a MOOC, and I decided not to do it. I was too busy at the time. I might be regretting it now because I might be either replaced by Michael Sandel or a robot. but I also do teach online, and I run an online course at the University of Washington that is being used as a model for other online courses. So a little pat on my own back there for myself.
Good job, Tony.
One of the interesting things that I have found, and I paint myself a little bit more on the skeptical side of the equation when it comes to these new technological innovations, so a little bit of a Luddite, but I jump into it because I saw it as a wave of the future, and also they offered me a little bit of financial compensation to do it, so I'm like, okay, throw a bone in front of me and I'll take that. I find it neat in some regards because you are able to reach a wider number of students. So more people can see Michael Sandel teach his ethics class. More people are able to hear my political economy classes because I can offer that class every quarter instead of just in the winter term when I normally do it. But one of the problems, and this is somewhat paradoxical given the creative destruction of technology and how quickly everything seems to be changing, is that once you make that recording of Sandel or I record my political economy class, it tends to get set in stone and it doesn't change very much. And relative to the traditional way of teaching, having the professor enter the classroom and some students seated there in desks, that course actually changes a lot more than these online classes I have found. And I teach my political economy course. It's a popular course at the University of Washington every year. And every year I make little changes to it. I learn things like, oh, I should have been emphasizing that. Or I'll read something new and I say, oh, this is a neat way to present it. And so every time I enter the classroom, there is a new class. It's slightly modified. But with these online classes, and I would assume the same thing with a MOOC when you're being filmed, because the filming takes a while, and you know, once you do it, you don't want to have to do it over again. That class that was filmed in, say, the year 2011 is going to stay that way in 2015. It's not going to change very much. In fact, I've already had this feeling or had this experience that I've wanted to go back and change my online course and add a few things and subtract a few things, but the cost of having to go back and do that is pretty, it's not immense, but it's just enough to, for me to say, nah, I'm not going to do it. So it almost seems that technology can antiquate some of these classes.
I think that's a really good point. And that's an argument that the face-to-face people would tend to make. And I agree. I mean, I have a similar experience to you. I have been teaching for several years now, but I have yet to teach the same course exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. In fact, every time I have offered a course, I have made significant changes in what I do. I'm, you know, constantly tweaking, never satisfied. And you're exactly right. If I had put together a package that was maybe I had recorded a lot of my lectures, you know, me sitting in a nice library talking about these things and drawing on a whiteboard, and then let's say that I decided that something in lecture 9 was not right, I'm not sure I'd want to go back and refilm it.
Yeah, it's even though the cost of filming and the cost of podcasting and the cost of online technology is dropping quite a bit, there's the time cost. It's just right. A pain to get back in there and then do the whole thing over again.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Tell me about the changes this is having on the faculty. One of the things you mentioned that this could endanger careers, and one of the things that you wrote about in your article was that we're starting to see the emergence of a two-tier faculty system. Explain that a little bit.
Well, in terms of just the way things are, even before we get to the issue of technology, and I think you'll probably appreciate this with your economic hat on, tenured faculty are not great economic inputs. And the reason I say that is because it is very hard to be flexible with tenured faculty. Mm. Tenured faculty have a lot of rights and privileges, and tenured faculty cannot be gotten rid of. They don't really vary based on the number of students you have, things like that. Schools are extraordinarily reluctant to declare economic exigency and to fire a tenured faculty on that basis. And so, rationally, schools have reacted to this by finding alternate ways to meet their faculty needs. And it's not only things like graduate students, but they create these kind of quasi-faculty roles, you know, visiting professorships or maybe instructional staff, people who may be ABD or master's prepared or even have their PhD, but they're in some kind of postdoc that involves teaching, that sort of thing. Schools are finding ways to get more flexible inputs than the tenured faculty member. And I think I saw a study that this category of kind of quasi-faculty members just continues to grow. So that's even without considering technology, mm-hmm. Okay? Then, when we bring technology into the picture, let's move from Sandel to James Q. Wilson. James Q. Wilson, probably the dean of the American government teachers. And Wilson has, you know, kind of the popular textbook that all academics dream of, you know, that has been adopted and used a gazillion times by sections of students all over the country. It is a very, well, in fact, I taught a course. I haven't taught American government in some years, but recently I had to fill in for someone who was on sabbatical. And when I got the textbook, I was surprised to find that they basically sent me the entire course in a box. Uh-huh. They sent me the textbook, they sent me the slides, they sent me the tests, you know, everything. If I had wanted to, I could have done very, very little work based on what was provided to me out of the box. Mm-hmm. And it's a very small step from that to basically then include the lectures by James Q. Wilson.
Yeah.
Now, he died a few years ago, maybe a couple of years ago, but if Wilson was still alive, they would simply get him in the studio, they would record the, you know, 30 or 45 lectures, however you want to put that together, and all you would need, you would not need Hunter Baker to teach that class.
Mm-hmm.
You could do it very well with a master's prepared person, who had a pretty good understanding of American government, and the students would get James Q. Wilson and the master's prepared person. Or maybe they get somebody like me with a PhD, but you're not going to be willing to pay that person with a doctorate what you would have been willing to pay them if they are truly the content creator.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, too, and as I start to think about this type of model of courses in a box, essentially, in many ways, how high school curriculums are often prepared with standardized text. And again, yeah, just put in the audio or video and, you know, you have an entire course there. Is the degree of standardization that education might be facing? I mean, one of the nice things about having individual faculty make up their own courses is it leads to something that academics love to champion all the time, which is diversity. The political economy class that they get from Tony Gill at the University of Washington is going to be different than the one at Union University given by Hunter Baker, or the one at Baylor given by somebody, or the one at Michigan. And that's kind of a neat thing, because then as those students graduate and go into the professional marketplace, they come with lots of different ideas. They bump up and mesh or bump up and challenge one another, and you get something very dynamic as compared to, say, something like James Q. Wilson. Oh, I had that course at Michigan. Oh, yeah, I had that course at the University of Mississippi, et cetera. And everybody's had the same thing. It almost sounds like the old Napoleonic écoles, where they wanted to standardize everybody. And, you know, now the French bureaucracy all comes from the same school and has read the same books and has been in the same classrooms with the same teachers all the time.
Right. That's right. That's another really good point you make. Now, I suspect that even if we move toward this course in a box system that I've talked about, that you'll see the same kind of proliferation that we've seen in our media, right? So there'll be your liberal American government person. You know, there'll be schools that'll want the Howard Zinn American history, and there'll be schools that'll want something that maybe somebody at Hillsdale would produce, you know, that's heavily constitution-based, you know, Matthew Spaulding or something like that. So I think that you'll have the liberal, the conservative, the Christian, the Jew, you know, all kinds of different takes, but the diversity may come from 5 to 10 people instead of from several thousand different professors.
Yeah, so there'll be some diversity, but it'll start to coagulate around a handful or a dozen or so. Yeah. Okay. Interesting changes there. And interesting changes as well when, as you mentioned, with the faculty, that there's more of these adjunct or quasi-faculty members that are being trained. And I know a lot of our graduate students are quite worried about that, because we've been keeping the number of graduate students we accept pretty constant. But as we look forward, you know, 5, 6, 7 years when they start graduating, I'm starting to see the market for the standard faculty member shrinking and the market for these adjuncts growing. I mean, there might be a great deal of labor unrest in the university system as a lot of these students graduate and can't find jobs.
I think that's right. I mean, and the other thing is that one thing that is having a strange effect on supply is that you have a lot of these pure online outfits producing people with doctorates, which kind of also adds to the supply. You know, a friend of mine was telling me about an institution where a number of the business faculty had these University of Phoenix business doctorates. So, you know, that will have a confusing effect on the market. I remember I was embarrassed because I went to a gathering of faculty at a conference, and we were talking about hiring procedures, and I said that I just ruled out applicants who had online only degrees, and a young woman who was there was very offended that I said that because she had one such degree.
Ruh-roh.
Yes, you know, and I had to kind of backpedal my way out of that, but you know, I mean, the market is confused because people like you and I, who had a more typical graduate school experience, right? You know, the the assistantship or the fellowship, the working for a professor, the spending your days crawling around the library. It's your full-time existence, almost like a weird kind of monastery or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are those of us who are like that out in the marketplace. And then there are the folks who have done this kind of online sort of a deal out there. And really as offering themselves as a new input into the process, and maybe a much cheaper input.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a, you know, right now everything is in flux.
Yeah.
In higher ed.
Do you see a segmentation or specialization aspect starting to wash over the higher education business, that if you went back, I would say 50 or 60 years ago, and you thought about going to college or a university, it was all pretty much the standard Ivy covered building, and you were going there with the stodgy professor with the white hair in the front of the classroom kind of experience. But now you have the University of Phoenix, you have smaller technical colleges, community colleges have expanded. Is that something that is occurring with greater frequency, or is speeding up, or and is this a good or bad thing? What's your thoughts on that?
I think it is going to occur. I think there's going to be a massive amount of diversity entering into the system. What I believe is that the university ultimately is going to come to resemble the American hospital of, say, the 60s or 70s.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is the American hospitals during that period did not have doctors who worked for the hospital. The doctors were all camped out in offices around the hospital and in the community, and then they would have a relationship with the hospital where they would come and provide services at the hospital from time to time. I think that that is what's going to happen with faculty members.
Hmm.
I think that faculty members are going to become more like doctors or lawyers. You'll have some kind of accreditation of individuals. More so than of institutions. And then individuals who are accredited to teach will be able to offer courses for credit. And therefore, in that future, somebody like Tony Gill might have a relationship with University of Washington where he's gonna offer his well-known course, you know, a couple of times a year with University of Washington. But he can also have maybe a select number of students that he's working with via video chat online, and they too will be able to put that course on some kind of a transcript.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that what's going to happen is it's going to be, the whole thing is going to break up into a lot of pieces that people will be allowed to kind of put together into a sort of imagine a patchwork kind of transcript of college work.
Mm-hmm. In a very Hayekian way, that is very interesting, and I think it's a model that many libertarian folks would look forward to and say, oh, that's really, you know, Schumpeterian creation, Schumpeterian, what do you call that?
Creative destruction.
And it bodes well for the future. But again, as somebody who is seeing his hair start to gray and is used to the old traditional things, it's kind of scary from my end.
I mean, you know, one of the things that I tell faculty members, I was on the highly skeptical side. In fact, when I was at HBU, Houston Baptist University, you know, we were really building our identity around maybe being the one institution in the entire city, other than, now that I think about it, University of St. Thomas Catholic School, that was really going to kind of major in the liberal arts.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come to us and say, you need to do this online stuff. And at the time, my response was, no, we're going to distinguish ourselves by not doing the online thing. You know, we're going to not do technology. And so that's kind of where I was coming from. But what I have come to see is is that these changes are going to happen whether I want them to or not. Now, there will be a few institutions that will be able to be just highly, highly traditional. I think about maybe Thomas Aquinas College or something like that. They'll be very traditional. And they will be fine. There'll be room for that, just not a lot of that. Faculty members who are under 55, basically, I tell them, you're too young not to learn how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all, if we want to have a future, and be marketable, we have to kind of learn how to do this and deal with it. We can't really ignore it any longer.
Yeah. No, I hear those rumblings, too, in our department that there are the older folks that are skeptical about it, and then there are the younger folks that say, yeah, let's go full steam ahead with this. And I'm kind of right there in the middle, and I've done a little bit of it, but still a little bit worried. You brought up the issue of St. Thomas Aquinas. They're a very traditional liberal arts school that focuses on philosophical training. And one of the things that people are raising some concern about is that as you get this new movement toward technology, this Schumpeterian creative destruction where students can piece together all these different ways they want to learn, it might erode the traditional liberal arts education. I mean, if you, again, go back 50, 60 years ago, prior to the, I would say, 1960s or 1950s, when you went to college, you had your philosophy class, you had your history class, you had your English literature classes. It was you dealt with all the great books and such. And over the past several decades, that has been withering away at many universities. And it seems that technology might, allowing students to pick what they want to do, really erode the ability for faculty curriculum committees to set a traditional liberal arts education. Is that a concern?
I think that's a huge concern. I think that the core curriculum is in huge danger right now. Higher education, for a variety of reasons, part of it being continuing government subsidy, has become extraordinarily expensive because of the high cost of tuition. What's happening is that political figures are now saying we have to find ways to make education less expensive. I know, let's require people to do a 3-year bachelor's degree instead of a 4-year degree. And, you know, and eventually the pressure will be for 2 or for something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hey, now in politician style, we have just cut the cost in half, mm-hmm. right? We've cut the cost by a fourth. We've cut it in half because we have declared that it will be no longer than 2 or 3 years. as this pressure mounts, and the other side of it is that the majors keep growing. You know, the nursing major gets bigger. Various other healthcare majors and business majors get larger, and they want more and more real estate. So there's all this pressure on the core. And at the same time, colleges have not done a good job of justifying the core. Mm-hmm. It has instead been kind of this grab bag 2-year type deal that people have to go through. We typically don't have a coherent core curriculum with really well-stated goals for the core curriculum. You know, that we expect that once a student goes through our core, they will have kind of this particular mindset and these particular abilities and skills. And most of all, they'll be really well prepared to learn in their major field. That's what a core should do. But instead, it can be a grab bag, and a lot of stuff can be taught by adjunct professors, and it hasn't been very well thought through. I think that the core is going to by a thousand cuts, kind of eventually die.
Yeah.
And I think that those institutions like Thomas Aquinas or St. John's that offer kind of a legitimate liberal arts education will be kind of little oases. In that desert.
I want to bring together two things you just mentioned. One was the increasing cost of higher education. And we could spend hours just discussing that, but let's take that as a given now. And I want to point out that as states are less willing to subsidize some of the large state schools, tuition's going up there. There's issues with how financial aid actually tends to fuel the rising price of tuition as well. And what is happening is that a lot of state schools, which were seen as cheap alternatives to your Harvards, your Princetons, and your other private universities, they're becoming as expensive as some of these private universities. And what I have noticed is that even some of the smaller private religious schools are now offering tuition that's roughly equivalent, maybe a little bit more, than the state-run subsidized schools. And so that gap is narrowing. And I'm wondering, and you can speak to this from your position at that Baptist school known as Union University there in Jackson, Tennessee, is this a market opportunity for schools like Union, for schools like Northwest University. We talked with Joseph Castleberry a few weeks ago about the changes that they're doing at their religious institution. Is this an opportunity for these schools to say, hey, we're offering something really good here, and it's at the same price as your state university right down the street? Come to us. Is this a growth opportunity for schools?
I have no doubt that if Union University were at the same cost as the University of Tennessee or other schools, you know, University of Memphis, the state schools, I believe that we would probably have double our enrollment or maybe more. There is still a substantial gap. University of Tennessee, I'm just going to ballpark it. Their tuition may be, you know, say $8,000 a year right now, whereas at least our sticker price here is probably like $25,000. Mm. Now, there are a number of kind of discounts and scholarships. So let's just say that maybe our real tuition price is closer to $15,000 or $16,000. there's still a significant gap. But if that were to continue to narrow, I believe there are many, many parents who would say, I prefer the idea of my student being at Union. I prefer the idea of my student marrying somebody that they meet at Union. Mm-hmm. I prefer the professors my student will learn from at Union. And we would actually experience a lot of growth on that basis.
Yeah, and that gap is narrowing. I've noticed this at in Washington, and again, we had that discussion with Joseph Castleberry a few weeks ago, that the gap between Northwest University, which is an Assemblies of God-based Christian school here in the Puget Sound region, is not that much different than the University of Washington now. And they are aggressively pursuing expansion, saying, you know, hey, we offer the same kind of value in a more intimate environment, and we're teaching more core curriculum and paying attention to that as well. That might be one place where the core curriculum is actually preserved in a lot of places.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, it's something else. And actually, you reminded me, there is Lee University here in Tennessee, near Chattanooga. I think they're in Cleveland, Tennessee, and they are a Church of God school.
Mm-hmm.
A shockingly beautiful campus there in that beautiful eastern part of the state. And last I checked, their tuition was really, really reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow, either through gifts or expenditure control, they have really got that tuition down. And their numbers were going just way, way up. So I would say that they are successfully competing with the state schools on price. If you can get close, the Christian school will win with the Christian market.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And that brings me to the other article that you wrote about the state of Christian higher education. Review that article for us. Are there reasons to be optimistic about the state of Christian higher education, or are there some concerns on the horizon here again, too?
It goes both ways. The concerns, you know, I talked about Alan Guelzo, who is maybe the nation's preeminent Lincoln scholar, who also is a Christian. He teaches at Gettysburg College, I believe, which I think is not necessarily a Christian school, more of a standard liberal arts type institution. And he raised all these points about Christian schools, many of which are true. One is, Christian schools are radically underfunded. you know, Union University, for instance, we have an annual budget of over $90 million, but our endowment is only about $34 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we receive... it may be going down. We receive about $2.5 million a year from the state's Baptists. So if you turned that into endowment, that would maybe be like another $50 million of endowment. but the point is that almost every Christian school, in fact, you know, there are a few exceptions. Baylor is an exception. Baylor has over $1 billion in endowment.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, Christian schools do not have much endowment. They have very little insulation against financial disaster. They are not able to subsidize their own operations very much at all. So there's that problem.
Well, why can't they get the alumni to donate? I mean, you got great loyal alumni to that Union University. What's your mascot?
We are the Bulldogs.
The Bulldogs. You got your Bulldog alumni. They should be given lots of money to the endowment.
I think there are a couple of issues there. One is that when students pay a higher private school tuition, I think that they feel that they have done their part.
Mm.
You know, I mean, when I went to Florida State, it cost me about $600 a semester, and in fact, it was all scholarshiped.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you said to me, Hunter, you owe Florida State something, right? You know, because because you got this education essentially free, I would probably say, yeah, you're probably right about that. but if you say it to a kid who's paid, let's say, $20,000 for each year for 4 years, they might say, I've done my share.
Yeah.
Right? So there's that. Then the other side of it is that young people who go to a place like Union, they are going, I mean, the kids at this university, they go to church. And not only do they go to church, they probably tithe.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're tithing 10% off the top, that diminishes your ability to give to your school in the same way maybe a Harvard grad does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can imagine that. You know, you start to get spread pretty thin, and
yes.
You're saying, well, you know, I'm told to give to God first, Union
yes.
University your second, but I'm a little tapped out right now. Yeah, I can
imagine. You know, and I'll give you one more thing. Mm-hmm. I think that one reason that the giant transformative gifts are rare in the Christian sector is that there is a great awareness of the many Christian schools that were effectively bought out of their Christian conviction.
Mm-hmm.
If you read Marsden's The Soul of the University, he talks about a Carnegie endowment that was in operation in the early 20th century that basically just went around buying schools out of their Christian commitment,
mm-hmm.
You know, offering them access to certain benefits if they would cut their denominational ties. And I think that there's a feeling among donors that, you know, if I give you that $100 million gift, will you then become insulated from the people in the denomination, and will you develop in a secular way?
That is a really interesting point, because this is something that has bedeviled a lot of Christian universities over time. I mean, you go back and you think about Yale University was founded as a Christian university, Princeton, and it still has Princeton Theological Seminary. But if you walk around the non-theological seminary part of campus at Princeton or at Yale, it doesn't really seem like a Christian university anymore. And that, I mean,
right.
They've had several centuries to slide in a more secular direction, but even some of the schools that are noted to be religious schools, such as Notre Dame, many people have leveled critiques that, oh, they're losing a little bit of their Catholic flavor, and they're trading it out to become a contemporary or a peer institution with the University of Indiana or University of Michigan, and so they, in many ways, are losing their Christian soul.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, there may be one of the issues there is how much do you buy into kind of functional differentiation? I think that Notre Dame, this is the charge that David Solomon leveled against them while he was there. He may still be there. He complained that if Notre Dame had a choice between two very strong candidates and one candidate was a great Catholic, but the other candidate was maybe even only slightly more well-published, they would hire the slightly more well-published person.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, they made their own efforts at gaining rank and prestige more important than fulfilling the mission of the institution.
And that brings up another issue that you brought up in your article on Christian higher education, and I thought this was a very insightful one, is that in an effort to become a great university, a lot of these Christian universities want to, you know, justify their tuition prices, so they want to hire well-trained very good faculty. They oftentimes come from secular trained programs, that they're coming from a Harvard, they're coming from a University of Michigan, they're coming from, UCLA or something like that. And those folks who spend those times at UCLA and at Michigan and at Harvard, even if they started out with a Christian background, oftentimes tend to lose that. And that's the faculty members that are being hired. And there's very few institutions that actually produce a lot of these PhDs. Now, again, you know, you're saying, well, you know, we're starting to get the University of Phoenix PhDs, et cetera, but there's still some panache to hiring somebody from a Harvard and have them on your faculty. I mean, we list that on our website, you know, so-and-so is from Harvard, so-and-so is from Princeton. Look at how good our faculty is. What are your thoughts there?
I think that is a serious problem that we have. I think that, however, there has been there's been progress made in that area. The main progress being that Baylor now has a variety of PhD programs. I can tell you that in our world, the world of kind of maybe the CCCU schools.
What's CCU? What is that?
Oh gosh! all those C's stand for like Christian Council, Christian Council of Colleges and Universities, something like that.
All right.
Basically, it's all the schools that would have a mission that you could legitimately say is kind of Orthodox Christian.
Okay.
So all of those schools and the Baptist schools like Union. We would look to Baylor as a great place for us to find strong PhDs. So in that sense, at least there is finally somebody in that business. Notre Dame was in that business, although, you know, there it would vary somewhat depending on the program, but Baylor at least is actually, you know, a Carnegie One institution with a $1 billion endowment, and they have a variety of PhD programs. They're producing potential professors. And that provides us with with people who have not been trained necessarily in a totally secular environment that we can hire. We need about, you know, three or four more institutions to be doing that, but it's great that Baylor is.
You bring up Baylor, and I have to fully disclose here that our podcast is sponsored by Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, and you are a Baylor alumni, Sikkim Bears, right? You write very appreciatively of what Baylor has been doing over the past 10, 15 years or so. What has Baylor done that is that you feel is really plugging into making higher education, especially Christian higher education, better?
I think that what they did was that they took the challenge. you know, for some time, people have been saying that that Christian higher ed is not playing the game at the highest levels, that there is no institution in Christian higher ed, or maybe we should limit to the Protestant side since I can speak more of what I know, no Protestant or evangelical institution that anyone would really recognize as such was playing the game at the comprehensive institution level, meaning that they have the really strong faculty members, a lot of research activity, first-class facilities, NCAA Division I sports, you know, all these things in one package and a very substantial endowment. Baylor is the only institution that took up that challenge and has accomplished the goal. I mean, you know, Baylor... people sometimes joke that, you know, Robert Sloan is like Moses. You know, he didn't get to see the promised land, but effectively, you know, kind of did all the work to get Baylor there. That's what has happened at Baylor, and it's just immensely important that there is one institution that is like that, and it's a model, and it's an inspiration, and it's proof that it can be done.
Yeah, no, it is. You know, just speaking of my 20 years at the University of Washington, you know, if I would have mentioned Baylor 20 years ago, people would say, what, some small town liberal arts college, you know, out there in Central Texas, where you're talking about. But now it's people are paying attention to it. Not only that, it generated a Heisman Trophy winner, Robert Griffin III, but very serious academics and wonderful PhDs coming out of there, and a lot of scholarship. You take a look at their departments and the institutes that they have. And again, I'm tooting the horn of the hand that feeds me to some respect, but it is sincere in that Baylor has really, really changed the game, I think, for a lot of Christian universities. Do you see a lot of other Christian universities saying, hey, look at Baylor, we can do that too?
It's a really good question. You know, I talked to Mark Knoll not long after he made his move to Notre Dame, and he told me that when Baylor first started to really come on strong, that people at Wheaton kind of had to examine themselves and say, you know, are we gonna try to match Baylor? You know, because Wheaton for a long time had kind of reigned as the number one school for evangelicals, and he said that effectively they kind of made the decision, no, you know, we're going to continue to focus on undergrad and liberal arts and let Baylor, you know, do this on their own. It's tough. I mean, part of the reason that the mission was so urgent at Baylor is because Baylor was maybe the one place where you thought, I can see a clear path to this happening. Baylor, you know, outside of Texas, maybe not all that well known, but within Texas, Baylor has always been strong. Baylor is the oldest university in Texas, founded during the Republic of Texas. Baylor has, you know, a ton of appreciative alumni, has produced many, many of the state's most influential people, and certainly its law school has been tremendously influential, and there are many, many judges and kind of high-profile lawyers that have come out of there. And so they had a very strong base from which to start. And so you combine what they had with someone like Robert Sloan, who just has that kind of combination of cussedness and intellect to pursue connecting all the dots and making it happen, and there you go. I mean, you know, kind of God found his man and made it happen. I don't know where else I can identify that happening. We could probably do it here at Union if somebody gave us a transformative gift. You know, we have the land, and we have the right kind of population around us, and we're between Nashville and Memphis. So maybe we could do it if somebody would hit us with about a $200 or $300 million gift.
Well, you can make those checks out to Hunter Baker.
There you go. I promise. I'll deposit it with the university.
Well, as we finish up here, and we started out by talking about the immense changes that are occurring within higher education, not just Christian higher education, but higher education in general. It'll be very interesting to watch how these trends develop and how places like Baylor, how places like Union University adjust to these changes. And, I don't know. The future might be very bright. On the other hand, there might be things that we need to always be alert for. And it's people like you, Hunter, that write about these things, that make us aware about them and get us talking about them. So I will point people back to the articles that you wrote. And I want to thank you for discussing it today with us on Research on Religion.
Thank you. I love the podcast.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.